It was separated, it became chava.
Before chava,
it was
one person with two faces.
According to the Gemara in Bava Basra, there was one person with two faces.
Right.
And that second face was separated to become a separate human being. It says in the Chumash, the language is he took a tzela. A tzela has several meanings. One of them is rib, that's where the common idea of the rib comes from. But the other is a side. So according to this, he took a whole side of the of Adam, which had been part of himself and made it into a separate entity. And that was Chava. Before it was one personality. One personality with two faces now became a second personality.
So where does the sort of Lewis come from?
There's some sort of strange medrash. First of all, let's backtrack on this. There was no Lewis.
Oh,
yeah. It said that when Adam was in those 130 years before he had Shaitz, his third child, so it says that he was Moli Leland Veruchos. He gave birth to Leland, Lilith, and other spirits. So the Rambam, this is one of the classic Rambams in Mor Nevuchim, he says it means bad people. But the Pashat Pshat is it means demons, male and female demons. So Lilin refers to the female demons. But he had no demon wife named Lilith.
Oh, yeah, first wife.
No. Maybe there's some obscure, wacky medrash that says that, but none of the mainstream medrashim says
it. I think this is Zohar, that woman was actually Baal HaTzadon later on. She's not
Baal. Anything that you don't know where it comes from, you can attribute to the Zohar and be reasonably sure that nobody's going to contradict you. This does not mean that it is true. So I don't know. I'm not familiar with
her. A little example, Laila means she comes at night to men and...
I'm telling you, any female demon is called a Lilith. Not just one specific one.
Back in the day, wasn't it?
Don't take girls named Lilith.
Yeah. Huh?
Wasn't it bad luck to see say the name?
It could be. I don't know. I'm not aware that I'm not aware that we avoid saying certain names. They said people don't want to say names of certain demons, but... I don't think that necessarily is anything.
Would Rambam hold he could say those names, or he would say...
Yeah, of course.
Because he doesn't
buy into... He doesn't buy into superstition.
Okay.
At all. Yeah.
Are you planning to give Rosh Hashanah shmooze anytime in the future? Buy to Rosh Hashanah?
All right. Normally they tell me in Orch HaMeach that enough people speak about the Parsha and about Yosef that they don't want me to speak about the Parsha or Yosef, anything standard of that sort.
No, a preparation. Tefillah, you were supposed to give a tefillah, you never did.
Well,
yeah.
You ever say everything is determined in Rosh Hashanah? Does that mean throughout the year you can change it, or it's like, what's predetermining
that? So, Tzadik speaks about this. The Tzadik says, I actually learned this from Tzadik with a chavrus of mine last night. So the Tzadik says that there's a Gemara which says, "Kaman mispalinon ha'idna aktir v'amiriyeh." Like whom do we daven today? Meaning throughout the year, are people who are sick, or are the people who need a salvation? So the Gemara says, like Rabbi Yossi, because Rabbi Yossi says, "Adam nidon b'chol yom," a person is judged every day. So Rabbi Tzadik learns this Gemara as a fascinating. In a fascinating way, it says it's a proactive Gemara. What do you mean? In other words, really halacha should be like Rabbanah, that we only get judged on Rosh Hashanah. But when the Gemara said, like, whom do we daven today on people who are sick, like, and said like Rabbi Yossi, the Chazal were changing the halacha, and of course, as a result, changing how Hashem conducts the world. In other words, till that point, it may have been that people can only be judged on Rosh Hashanah, but Chazal at that point changed everything, and a person can have his judgment changed in the middle of the year. Okay? So therefore, in fact, if you look at the davening in Rosh Hashanah, the davening in Rosh Hashanah has very little to do with what is what I want or what I ask for the coming year. Even the entire concept of the judgment is mentioned in the Brach of Zichronos, in the middle of the Musa Shonetz, right? As mentioned in the Sana Tokef, which is a much later addition to the Chazaras HaShat. The rest of it is very little about the judgment because it's not the theme of the day. The theme of the day is the theme of
God's the King.
What?
God's
the King. Right. So therefore, since that's the it makes sense that is the case if you say, it certainly makes sense that's the case if you say that Chazal changed the nature of the world by allowing people to change their din midstream in the middle of the year. Now, the more conventional, non-Rebbetzin way of looking at things is that there are certain allocations which are set out on Rosh Hashanah, but of course they then come into actual fulfillment can be changed in the course of the year. The Gemara itself gives the example, if there was a decree there would be a lot of rain, but Klal Yisrael went bad in the middle of the year, so the rain would fall in places where it would do no good. And vice versa, the decree there was very little rain, so then it would come out in the most affected places if Klal Yisrael did tshuva. But the Gemara also says, talks about how a person is supposed to lose a specific sum of money every year, and if he's zoche, he loses it to tzedakah. If he's not zoche, he loses it to taxes or other things. And that also seems to be of the same ilk. In other words, that there are budget allocations made, and just how the question is how these budget allocations then come into actual play in practice. But like the point of Tzadok, all this might well have been in the past, but now we have the capacity actually to change things midstream. Now the truth is, probably in the old days, people were able to plan a whole year in advance because things didn't change so much. Now we're lucky if we can plan a whole day in advance. So, there's something to be said about how Chazal made the Hanhaga, the conduct, change with the times. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay.
Moshe Rabbeinu. The year that he died.
You really don't want to learn another year.
No, The year that he was supposed to die. So he was a judge of the Russia?
Yeah. Because Russia means, in this case, a person who is going to come out liable in terms of having to die. Absolutely. Yeah.
Does it say, in this year he will make that sin, or the sin was predetermined by the previous
year?
No,
sin happened in the past, yeah. I mean, this is only the Ramban who holds this way. The Tosfos seems to say that there is a judgment the Rambam. The Tosfos seems to say there is a judgment in the absolute sense on every Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, and that therefore Tzadik and Rasha don't relate to what's actually going to happen, but what you are. What's actually going to happen is a separate thing.
Oh.
According to Rambam, though, it's whether you're going to come out with a good judgment or a bad judgment, and nothing to do with your actual spiritual self.
One more time, Rambam defines tzaddik and rasha
for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur purposes as who's going to come out meriting a year.
Meaning living,
right,
or not living.
Right.
And if you died, then you did a sin?
No.
Otherwise you'd be immortal?
No. I mean, you could have died for some other reason. You're still called a Rasha in this case that you lost. No, it was a case, and you lost. Everybody's got a root from
that's
why
you died.
Right.
And when you die, you're torn called a Rasha.
It's close. So that's
I mean, what a different word. It's such a loaded word.
I know. That's a good question, but that's what it says. Tzadik Bedino, Rasha Bedino. In other words, when you go to a court of law in a basin, in theory, when you come out, one guy is the tzaddik. It's the way the Chumash uses it. B'tzikus ha-tzaddik v'yoshius ha-rosha. They justify the tzaddik. What I said, which is so funny.
Yeah, this is the class.
Another shir. It's coming up frequently.
Okay. B'tzikus ha-tzaddik v'yoshius ha-rosha means that they find this guy meritorious and this guy liable. But it doesn't mean tzaddik and rosha literally. Somebody can lose a court case and still be a righteous person.
So where does the other connotation come from? It's also Chumash? Would Russia as a working person?
Yeah. Yes. Where is it used in that context? I'm not sure actually if you use the Chumash that way. I think it's used. It's certainly used in Tanakh that way, right?
It says on the topic, who are these Rishonim? What is a Rasha in the other sense?
In what?
In the wicked person. What is it? What constitutes a Rasha?
There are many different definitions. Mara, you know, Mara says that when Moshe Rabbeinu said to the guy who, you know, Rasha Loma Taka Re'echa, right? So of course says Kol Merim Yadacha Deo Nikra Rasha. Anybody who lifts up his hand against somebody else is already called a Rasha. Rasha is a very elastic term. It can be used in many, many ways. There's a difference between Rasha and Ra. A really bad person is called Ra. Okay, like Haman Hara Hazeh. That's what Esther said when she revealed to Ahasuerus that he was the person who was behind all that. So, Ra is unambiguous. It means evil. Right? Rasha is relative. In other words, a person can have there are multiple definitions of Rasha, all the way from somebody who picks up his hand against somebody else to somebody who's committing grave sins. It's a very elastic term. Does that help at all?
Yeah.
It's interesting how the shin in the middle kind of changes things. I'm not sure. Maybe we can make something of that. But yeah.
On Tishrei, the first parsha, we'll start over again. Since the first parsha was...
One second. Rasha is the opposite of Eser, right?
Opposite of
Eser. Ten signifies completion. The Rasha is somebody who is not incomplete in some way, shape, or form.
Is it
Just came up with the spot.
How does Rasha and Eser connect?
Put the letters.
Okay.
Maybe put Kesser on the bottom.
Now you can start playing around with it. Go ahead now. The shin actually has the shin. The shin and ayin both have crowns on them. Okay. You can work with that. Yeah.
One more time. I think it's about 10 minutes before. So Haggadah. The Rosh though, they call the Rishonim the ones who didn't want to. The wicked son, and the wicked son says.
Why do we need it?
What does this work for you?
And he says the Rasha just—he doesn't realize his own neshama elokus. The Rasha is boner shalom. He doesn't an acronym. The boner shalom.
That's very good. That's
weird. How does it connect now?
Boner shalom is Rasha's Rashi tevos. The boner shalom.
You can't see the godliness within him. That's why it's the Rasha.
But he does have godliness within him. That's between the Rasha and Ra. The Rasha does have godliness. So you can just go with the good one. Oh, yeah.
No, that's what that is.
Okay. By the way, you know, with the Haggadah 101, the of course everybody knows, the son who is the other son, he's not a tzaddik, he's just a chacham. Everybody asks the question, you know, what's the difference between the chacham and the Rasha? There really is no difference. They're both wise guys. But one's smart and one's not smart. That's really just the difference between the two of them. Yeah. What are you going to ask?
Yeah, so since Tishrei is the beginning of the year, shouldn't we have the first parsha found on the first day of the year?
The first one?
First parsha?
Rashi.
Well, we only do parshas according to usually of Shabbos, except for Zos HaBracha. Why would you say that? I mean, Tom Nagoya, they didn't have the same cycle we have today necessarily, right?
Right, so I'll assume Tishrei is the month that was created. Tishrei is.
That wouldn't be fair to Nisan.
And Nisan applies to Hagim as a regalim.
So why not we create terms of that?
Yeah. Sure.
Shmini Atzeres, by the way, is the last Yom Tov of the year.
So
because
like the first
if you go with Nisan, no.
Oh, if you go with Nisan.
If you go with Nisan, it's Pesach till Shmini Atzeres. So therefore, it makes sense to start a new cycle after Shmini Atzeres. Okay? Yeah.
Wait, so what was the history towards, you know, our cycle? Like, for example, what I mean is they used to have every 3 years in Babel.
No, in Eretz Yisrael.
Eretz Yisrael?
In Babel, it was like we have today.
Okay. who have it today.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was based on the after the calendar, they had Hill calendar, so they had this.
I don't know if it was necessarily contingent on each other. Okay. You can have Kriyas HaTorah without having a six calendar.
Oh, so but what was the history behind
it? I don't know when it originated this way. I assume sometime with Tanakh Chazal, but I can't tell you for sure. I don't know exactly how the arrangement came about.
And how did the, do you know how like the calendar came, like what's the history behind that? Like,
what do you mean, what's the history behind it?
Why don't we do it like the way we used to do
it? We don't have real smich anymore.
Oh.
You can't, in order to do the calendar like they used to, you have to have real smich and real Sanhedrin.
Oh, so
you can't do it.
If you have a show thing, it says that there's no king in Israel. It's like the same.
You want to go to the end of the Sefer? Should we skip?
Well, if you go to that part, like the weirdest part in the whole Shoftim,
yeah.
The Pelagish and blood and the rape and the murder.
Yeah.
So now tell me, is it true that...
Wait.
So what's the connection between the beginning and the end?
And
in terms of what? I mean, well, this whole book is laying the groundwork for why there's a king, right?
Why there should be a king.
Yeah. Because Shoftim is the book of losers. Nobody was effective. Yeah.
When they went to Shiloh, or outside Shiloh, to kidnap the girls, did they do it without permission, or would they imply that they might have done
it? It's not clear. It's not clear.
No.
But
then
the
Kedush, how
the
Kedush
in a good
Kedush? No, they didn't actually marry them on the spot. They just grabbed them.
Yeah, but then you take them away
to...
Yeah, they weren't so from the old days. No. Seriously. Girls used to go to the mikveh. Now girls don't go to the mikveh. There's no Isser Megia if an unmarried girl goes to the mikveh.
Why was that?
Because of Tumen Tara Halachas.
Oh, so girls used to go to
the mikveh. You had to, you know, people were handling Truma of Meister Shani.
So girls should go to the mikveh today because there wouldn't be any problems if
we take. We want there to be a problem. That's the whole point.
But then you want people to get covered.
No, we want them not to touch.
But you didn't say halachically there's not an Isser Negia if an unmarried girl goes to the mikvah.
Right.
So I can, I mean, like, okay, well, I know I can. Okay, sure. That mean, like, really? There's like no Isser? Okay. Is that? It's also an issue of Tuma, not like...
Not Tuma. It's like a riot. In other words, she's forbidden for anybody to have relations with her.
Why? Because
she's Tara.
So she's Anita.
But how about issues of sneers?
She's what?
How about issues of sneers? Stam. Why do I need things that have to do with whether she was a mikvah or not?
Yeah, obviously, too, there are proper modes of conduct and improper modes of conduct. But that is already not much more of an issue of conduct in Derech Eretz, an issue of Isser and Heter.
Don't get any ideas.
No, I can see the wheels turning.
No, let's learn about people who sin for good purposes.
Nobody.
I love maybe we should.
Okay.
Can I say something around where... No. I went to the shul. I was in the young Israel upper century where this rabbi got up in front of a couple hundred people. Rabbi blessed. And he wrote a book in the Sistine Chapel to talk about how Michelangelo has all these secrets, how he was very sympathetic towards Jews, and was sort of laughing in the face of the Christians at the time. And he got up and he said that he somehow got into the Vatican. I said, that's my face. Wait. I have to say, it was a weird story.
Rabbi Blech, not Blecht.
Blech. So he went into the Vatican, and he saw the head cardinal and the Pope. And they're talking. So he says, how many items of Jewish interest might you have? And one of them says very insensitively, sort of arrogantly, I don't understand. He goes, 6 million. Whatever. Somehow, it turns out that they have the original manuscript of the Rambam, we use for Mishnah Torah. And he says there's a bit of a locus about whether the Rambam said that the three steps or qualifications for Kedushin, whether they're all the rites or ones that are rabbinic, which is giving an object over.
Right.
And he says he saw it inside, and said they're all the rites.
Yeah, that's brought down actually in some of the sources we have.
So why don't we do all three? They should do to get married.
They do all three.
No, they don't. No, just one. We do Kedusha Keset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing counts?
No, it's not Kedusha. No, it's not Kedusha. Well,
doesn't conceal the deal?
No, that's Christian. That's wrong religion. Okay, so let us start the sixth parak of Zhokhi on page K. The Jews did that which was evil in the eyes of God. So they were given over the hands of Midian for 7 years. So,
Weren't they wiped out already?
Who?
Midian?
Yeah, what do you mean? Because Moshe Rabbeinu wiped them out? Yeah. So they obviously were not completely wiped out. This is it's an interesting thing that, you know, all these people get wiped out and then come back. Amalek too. He's getting wiped out all the time, and then he comes back again. So there are two approaches. One is to say, well, it's not the same Amalek; it's the new guys, and they just took the name. But the other approach is to say that, you know, it's very hard to wipe out a nation completely, right? Especially by sword. You can wipe them out sometimes by assimilation, by population exchange, but by sword, it's very hard. And there are always guys who get away to renew the animosity in this case. Anyway, Mefarshim explicit notes that normally when we go back to revert to the state in which the Jews are doing bad stuff, it says Vayosifu Bnei Yisrael La'asos Rabbeinu Hashem. They continued, or they added on to do bad stuff. But here it says Vayasu, they did, and the difference is based on the idea. The difference is based on the what Dvorah accomplished. Dvorah accomplished, and some say it was accomplished because of this great song which she sang, which we saw the past few weeks. But the days of Dvorah, Klai Yisrael did a complete tshuva. So since they did a complete tshuva, therefore, it doesn't say here by Yosifu, they added on, but rather by Yasu. They started here, they started from scratch doing bad stuff because they had finished doing bad stuff beforehand. So they are now come. They now come to fight against. They are now sold into the hands of Midian. Now the first Jewish guy sold in the hands of Midian was
Moshe.
Who was the first Jew sold in the hands of Midian?
Oh,
Yosef. Right.
I have a question.
Okay, so the question is whether that's significant in this perek. The answer is yes, it will be significant. Not yet. Okay, pasuk beis. Vato'oz yad Midian Yisrael. The hand of Midian became mighty against the Jews. And b'pnei Midian, because of Midianites, also lahem b'nei Yisrael et hamin haros. The Jews made tunnels, asher b'harim, in the mountains, Esamiros, the caves, Esamitzados, which means fortified places. Not only that, Vaya im Zarah Yisrael, if Jews would plan, Va'ola Midian, Ve'amalek, Ubnei Kenem, Va'olu Arav. The Midianites couldn't have come alone. Once the Midianites started, everybody else jumped on the bandwagon. So it's interesting that all these people here, Midian, Amalek, and Bnei Kerem, are relatives. Meaning, Midian and Bnei Kerem are descendants of Keturah, who was Hagar, who was Avraham Avinu's concubine. And Amalek, of course, is a descendant of Esav, right? So it could be that this is what, you know, like Yaakov, like Yitzchak said to Yaakov, to Esav. He said, "Vayokasher tori ufarakto lo me'altavarecha." If you are going to be a slave to the Jews, but if the Jews mess up, you're going to rise up and take their yoke, the Jews' yoke, off your shoulders. So here too, we have basically these relatives who could claim that they come from the same stock as we do, and they are coming and usurping the leading role which the Jews were supposed to have gotten. And that's basically what Yitzchak said, he prophesied to Esav his grandchildren would do. Now, who are the Midianites? So I write here on page Payal, the name Reb Tzadok, he says the Midianites are rooted in the characteristic of Midonim, fact, in Chumash they're called Midonim in Bereishis. And Midonim means arguments and strife. It's interesting. This, of course, is also a trait of Amalek. So Midian and Amalek share this trait of being argumentative and full of strife. So these nations also are coming here not just to make an argument, to pick a fight with the Jews and create strife, but also to cause a strife between Klal Yisrael and Hashem. And that's why when Amalek came, the first time it says they cut off the bris milah of every of the Jews which were able to seize, and they tossed it up to heaven.
Oh, it wasn't their own?
Sorry?
It wasn't their own?
Not their own, no. The Jews. Why would they do their own? So the claim is that, you know, the Jews don't deserve to be chosen by you. And of course, by Midian, seduced the Jewish people to massive licentiousness in the case of Peor, right? But they're not just for the purpose of getting them to be licentious, but we know that that was a tool to get them to serve Avodah Zorah, to get the Jews to serve Avodah Zorah, because each girl would say, you know, I'm not going to have relations with you until you bow down to my little idol here. So therefore, the purpose was to sever the relationship between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the greatest in person in this great mission which these nations took upon themselves was Bilaam. Right? Bilaam was the one who tried to use the use his powers to sever the relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people, and thus destroy the Jewish people. So that's bad. But it's also, Midian can also be used for good. Who was good who came from Midian? She was from Moab.
Zipporah,
right? And her father, Yisro. So Yisro, how did Yisro become Yisro? We know that Yisro got into a big fight with the other people. That's why in Midian. That's why his daughters were not allowed to water their flocks together with the rest of the Midianite shepherds, and they had to wait for Moshe Rabbeinu to come and help them out. Because Yisro decided to break away. He was a high priest, and he broke away from that in order to search for truth. So there's a positive way to use strife. And when you create strife between yourself and undesirable elements.
So he was like the Pope who wanted to become who checked out different religions?
Right. That was Yisro. Yeah. That doesn't look too good.
Saying if you're in that position, then...
Right, that's why they didn't like him.
Oh.
Yeah.
And by the way, your quote, Rav Tzadik, not familiar with the source, you mentioned it a number of times, but what do we exactly do?
Rav Tzadik HaKohen Lublin was one of the greatest Hasidic rebels of all time.
Was he Hasidic?
What?
He was a Hasidic.
He wasn't Hasidic originally, but he became a Hasid.
Who's the Chazon?
What?
Not the
Chazon.
No.
Chazon was somebody else. It was a few generations earlier. So Rav Tzadik became a Hasid. He became a student of the Talmud of the Ishbitzer, and at the end of his life he was a Rebbe in Lublin. He was one of the most prolific Hasidic authors of them all. There's Sfarim and Sfarim and Sfarim, and his genius was that he came from a Lithuanian background, he was a brilliant Lamdan. Once the Rebbetzin, who was one of the great minds of the next generation, met Rav Tzadik, and he wanted to speak to Rav Tzadik in learning, because he knew Rav Tzadik was this amazing, brilliant Lamdan. And so I said to him, listen, all this stuff I did in my youth, before I found the true derech of Hasidus, and now I don't really have time for this Lamdan. Now I pursue different things. So the Tzadik became a Hasid, but he brought the characteristics of a Ritvisha Ilui with him. And if you read his poem, they are full of Shas, Midrashim, Kabbalah, everything was at his fingertips. And he knew everything. and he was able to combine it with deep thought. And that's why he is one of the most popular, he is the most popular chassid among the snagim.
Right.
Because
he wasn't put in chayram? If Sadek wasn't put in chayram for becoming Because I know the Bat Ishrava was going to say, put him in chayram,
No, he wasn't put in chayram. By that time, it was kind of, you know, it didn't really happen.
He's like the quasi
No, he was a bridge figure, but he was a chassid through and through.
Ah.
But he is a bridge figure, and his writings are extremely fulfilling, because they explain so many chazals, they bring them to bear and they explain them. It's amazing stuff and stuff.
Do you think
it's one of your favorite sources? Yeah,
one of my favorite. There's
like a lot of
literature about what? All my rosh hashiva that like quoted him.
Of course, because yeah. He's Ras Witzvox. He's palatable. Yeah. So,
is it something that you wouldn't be able to learn on your own because it's very tough to
you have to have some training in order to get into it. But you know, Rav Dessler is watered down with Tzodek. Rav Dessler writes is Rav Tzodek. Even when it's not attributed to anybody else, you can assume it's from Reb Tzadok.
Really? He got
some
Reb Tzadok, or he just his
ideas? He got it. Not that he learned Reb Tzadok, but I'm saying in his learning of Reb Tzadok, he got all this material.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, there's a lot of that. There's some of it from Spass. And the best, a lot of his sources were Hasidish, and, you know, he didn't, for obvious reasons, he didn't want to let people know that. So mm-hmm. He kept it a little secret.
And English of Rav Dessler does it justice, or
yeah, it's not bad. It's not bad. I don't know why we have all so many of them all of a sudden here, but
yeah,
we
got Maria and I share.
Oh,
it's
great. Which is
Rabbi Kellner.
Very nice.
Very
good idea.
Very good.
Well, yeah.
I thought Dessler was very deep. Very deep.
Taka Yitzchak also based on himself.
Yeah.
Wow. Everything comes from the Tzadok, yeah.
I didn't know he got it from some
Lutzfischer. No. When Rav Yitzchak Kuttner went to Yerushalayim, he became very close to Rav Kook. And from Rav Kook he got this whole mystical Hasidic approach, which is heavily based on the Tzadok.
Oh, I didn't know. Was Kook was Hasidic?
He wasn't Hasidish, he was Litvak, but he was one of those, you know, people who attempted to bridge the gap between Litvisher and Hasidish. Like Rav Dessler, like Rav Gedalia Shor, you know everything Rav Gedalia Shor says and everything that Rav Yisrael Simcha Shor says, also, either Rav Tzadok or Svat Emes. Right? This all comes from these sources. Anything deep and profound, you can assume.
So who did Rav Tzadok learn this stuff from?
The Yishbitzer.
Yeah.
But he took the Yishbitzer as much. The Yishbitzer was a radical, fascinating thinker, but he took it much further. He took it all around with it.
Wow,
yeah.
But Yishbitzer is kind of interesting in and of itself, right?
There was,
like, certain ideas, don't they have, like,
yeah, no free will, yeah, things like that.
I don't understand why. Should have asked about your sources. It gets off. I don't understand. Why isn't the Alpha Sobotka? Why isn't there any, like, Alpha Sobotka, like, from or anything?
There is. It's all that stuff.
Yeah.
So the Alta Slobodka did not write. Some people recorded his shmuzim. The Alta from Slobodka was not interested in making svarim. I believe he said this. He was interested in making people.
Whoa.
So he did not write any svarim.
Yes, sir.
And the Alta from Slobodka was one of the greatest mechanzim of all time. You know what the Alta from Slobodka's greatness was? He could produce many great students, and they weren't all the same. And each was very different. Today, the successful yeshiva is one which puts everybody into the same mold, and they come out the same. They look the same, they talk the same, they even have the same sense of humor, because they went through the same institution, and the mold was put on them. That's not real chinuch.
Wow.
Real chinuch is everybody should be different.
Right. The bach is one for individual. Each individual with their special...
You
know,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you can go like a Hasidic yeshiva or a Litvish yeshiva. Is there like a Mozart yeshiva?
No. They don't exist.
Oh,
well,
should there be one?
Of course.
I feel like it's sort of like the streams as if it's just like eroding.
Correct. Doesn't exist.
What
Chavetz Chaim
is all about?
Let's say Chavetz Chaim is more pays more lip service to most of the Nadi yeshivas, but they're not actually doing a musa in the sense that they're focusing on their character growth and development.
But isn't it
they listen to the Rosh Hashiva Shmuzim and they chazen them and they all, you know, they held of them very powerful, in a very powerful way, but that's not quite the same thing.
Don't the Chiddush and the Chumash have to come through like a Musa based Chiddush?
What?
When they look into a Chumash, right, and they look on into a wild and impartial, so when they come to approach a new idea, they do it through the outlook of a Musa.
Who's they?
Chiddush.
Yeah, right. They like the psychological insights.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not the same. There's not a concerted effort to make people change their character.
Is it possible?
Hey, I went to Chavetz Chaim.
Did?
Yeah, I was there for high school and for 2 months in Beit Medrash.
Oh, wow.
So is that the way? Is that the style you're doing now?
No.
No?
No.
Is it possible that this erosion or extinction of Mutzer, practical Mutzer learning is due to what Rav Shach once said about the world? He said the world has not yet recovered from the first two world wars. He said before then people were interested in developing personality and character and faith, even among the women in general. And after the world wars, it became a very cutthroat, look out for number one kind of place in this world. And so nowadays, you know, now it's all about money. Now it's all about getting ahead, staying on top of the other guy. But back in the old days, it was more like there was more of an honor system. There was more of a personality or character development worldview because we were traumatized by the whole event. So would it be that just Musa just can't survive in a world that's been filled with a bunch of cutthroat roots?
I don't know if that's true. I don't think that's true.
Yep.
But I think I'll tell you what I do think is true. I thought you were saying, but you didn't end up saying this, is that Orthodox Judaism, particularly the yeshiva world, after World War II, went into this mode of intensive care. Intensive care, by that I mean that there was a danger of true learning dying out, and therefore we had to promote learning over as the top priority over anything else. The problem is that 60 some odd years later, we're still pretending that we're in recovery mode. And therefore, we justify lots of stuff by saying, well, we're still recovering from the devastating effects of the Holocaust. That means that overrides also a lot of stuff which was important, but peripheral. Now it's just not done, like Moser.
It could be there's also another event that happened that we never recovered from.
The Korean War.
Vietnam War.
That's true. He's right. Vietnam.
1970. Because Shlomo is right.
The yeshivas were also. No, Shlomo. He's right about this. Might sound funny, but he's right.
Arab world, Israel, Europe.
America.
Expected?
America, because since in the 70s, it had an advantage and disadvantage. In the late 60s and 70s. The population of the yeshiva world in America burgeoned. It was bursting at the seams because nobody wanted to be drafted and fight in Vietnam. So yeshivas were full to the brim with both real students and imaginary students. So
change things to the composition. Probably they had to respond to this new nominal crowd to some degree, making things easier.
Watering down.
So now we're kind of dealt.
We dumbed down the
system. We're in a hangover now. We have a hangover.
Right. We dumbed down the system and we made it available to people who shouldn't have been there.
I guess.
Yeah. In order to keep them out of the draft. Okay.
Does 9/11 continue that trend?
I don't think that did anything. I don't think anything would change from before September 11th to after September 11th. I don't think you can. You think of anything that's changed?
No, people traumatized.
I know people get so traumatized.
Since we're wrapped up, anyway.
That's the second time you said that.
Okay, well,
we're staying off the topic now.
Go ahead, Heather. When are we going to get back to the topic?
Yeah. Go ahead. No, he wants to ask the question. You might as well ask yours.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
Are the major scholarships today in Israel and America only? Is the major Torah centers? Before it was like, you know, Europe, and Israel wasn't really existing. Now it seems like it's Israel and America with like last traces. But not only in New York State.
I don't know, New York State, New Jersey.
Lakewood.
The greater New York area.
Northwest or in the hemisphere?
Northeast.
Northeast,
yeah.
Right.
So?
Am I correct?
Yeah. What was I supposed to say? There's a major center Torah in
Australia?
No.
There's
Havana.
Yeah.
I heard this. Is there a Gemara that has, that it says that in the days of Mashiach, prior to coming to Mashiach, besides great catastrophes and things like that, there will be an arrow that knows how to send itself, knows how to direct itself, because this was being taught by a big personality in Judaism in the New York City the other night, from which a few of our guys here came back very excited, and they said that there were allusions in the Gemara to such things such as nuclear weapons, i.e. arrows, described as, in those terms, arrows that could steer themselves and then go across oceans to other countries and wipe out 2/3 of the world's populace if there anything less about this.
That's weird.
Wait.
Sounds pretty cool.
was this fellow was on the
list? I didn't mention names for reasons.
Okay, carry on, please.
Question. Yeah, we're not carrying on, no?
Since you guys don't want to carry on, yes.
You mentioned some rabbis did not want their writings to be written down, or did not write anything down. Yet their students did. How sure can we be that what their students did write down, how eminent it is and like valid?
Well, yeah, they have to be students we're familiar with.
See, if you didn't want to write down, there was a purpose why you didn't want it to be written down, yet they wrote them down anyway.
He might not have been able to be bothered, but he maybe was very happy that the students wrote it down.
But then
he didn't want to take the time out to write himself.
Okay.
The students who wrote over the altar from Sabotka stuff, they in themselves were great people. So that's why we trust them on this.
So we trust him, but nobody like put a chiddush in his name.
But maybe somebody did, but you know, they were great guys, so the chiddush probably isn't bad anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
One is, I have a rabbi that I know from Israel. He said that he doesn't believe that like there's printing mistakes in the text in like different form, like it's for, like the Gemara, because he feels like it was such a precious thing, like it wouldn't like get printing mistakes because like okay fine, your printers they have mistakes, but like why are they making a mistake with like something as chashev in a form as Gemara?
Why do you say things too annoyingly? You like annoying me. That's why you said right? That's totally absurd.
Really?
Yes. Uh-huh. Reb David Cohen was one of the great Talmid Chachamim alive today. He was a rabbi in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
He had a sefer, all the typos in the Vilna Shas.
Wow.
It's a thick book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's based off the fact that they weren't really religious to start with.
No, neither were the religious.
The what?
Neither was religious, not religious.
Uh-huh.
That's the nature of the printing.
Okay.
You repeat the typos.
What? In the Chumash, the five books of Moses. Are there any...
The newer ones have more mistakes. Because newer ones were scanned from older ones, and in the scanning process, a lot of errors crept in.
Same with the Chumash itself.
Usually not in the Chumash so much as the Unkus and Rashi.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I heard that they weren't allowed to give over the Torah that exactly word for word. They had to change certain stuff.
Not the printers. The printers made mistakes.
Oh, it wasn't that they weren't allowed to...
No, it wasn't that they left something cryptic. No, the printers made the mistakes.
Oh,
yeah.
The Torah about Pet, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. What do you mean, it doesn't matter? Leads people astray all the time. In Babri, it's not so bad. In Yerushalmi, it's horrific.
Why is it worse in Yerushalmi than
Because Babri, lots of Rishonim and early Achronim already fixed most of the stuff.
And Rishonim, there's no Rishonim on?
No.
There's nothing?
Nothing consistent. I mean, plenty of Rishonim. Clearly, we're speaking about Rishonim, but there's no running commentary.
When Rambam then is
missing. But you know, your this rabbi fellow you're quoting.
Yeah.
What does he do with the Bach on the side of the Gemara? Who came in the 1600s, the late 1600s,
right.
And decided, well, there's a mistake here, there's a mistake
right.
There.
He goes to the Bach, but he says, I think the Bach doesn't do it on every single thing or whatever isn't correct. Like, he doesn't have everything correct. Or he's like, well, there's certain things that are. Then Rashi does, like, you know, he doesn't, you know, go on. I don't remember so exact. I mean, I just remember what he said. Like, he just said, he used to say, like, the Masorah is good, it's intact, you know, it's not, you know, some old Soifer somewhere that, you know, didn't copy the right way or some, you know. That's what he said.
Doesn't hold water.
Okay. And can you explain the Ishbitz, no for you also?
The Ishbitz are held that it's possible to say that nothing you do in this world is subject to your free will.
Okay, then Rambam is calling a fool.
Right. But the Ishbitz didn't care, obviously.
Whoever says that there's no free will is an idiot.
I'm telling you what the Ishbitz says, though. He obviously disagreed with the Rambam. What do you mean, how does he disagree?
So Rambam was a Rishon. He was a Ha.
But this is matters of a Machshava, it's not Halacha.
Well,
not Allah, huh?
But you have to find out how she got fucked.
Yeah.
So what can you find?
Halacha. Yeah.
So could we fight on, like, with the Gedolim?
By the way, you can fight on Rishon, don't get me wrong. You can.
No, we wouldn't.
Yeah, you'd just be a total idiot. We'd put you away in the same asylum. But it's not as if it's awesome.
Oh, so we have to fight with the Gedolim today then.
Of course.
But if it's or not?
What?
Like, Ishbitzer could say things on Rambam, he was crazy.
Some people do. But he said, you only have Bechira on your attitude. How you respond. So, it's not, Ripsadik definitely didn't hold it that's true all the time. I doubt Ishbitzer held it true all the time also, although it sounds like him, from him, that it is. But really, your Bechira is only internal, not external. Your interaction with the world can be totally predetermined.
So how does he type the Gemara that says, Ein Adam?
What?
And
I'm chayte.
Yeah,
a person who thinks he's sinning and does it because he wants to sin is clearly insane. That's what we want to say. I'm not insane, but
a
chayte.
Yeah.
Well,
Rabbi Brown quoted somebody in this year. The Nicholsburg Rebbe, as one where he cited a story about the Nicholsburg Rebbe, who he called one of the greatest Hasidic masters of all time. Now,
Schmelkum Nicholsburg. Not today's Nicholsburg.
No, but that's the thing.
But he was misquoting. It wasn't Schmelkum Nicholsburg. It was Reb Zusha.
Oh, okay. So you were there. Okay. So Reb Zusha is the one who picked up his capote or whatever it was?
If anybody, that's one. Reb Schmelkum Nicholsburg was actually later.
Okay, so he was considered one of the big. I've never heard of him. I had never heard of that particular
which
line. Around the Nicholsburg.
There is no line.
And that's what I thought. Now, this rabbi, I understand, was not born a rabbi.
No, he was a Satmar Chassid.
So he's a Satmar Chassid, and
yeah.
He became the Nicholsburg.
He broke, yeah, he's born.
How did he become the Nicholsburg? He's never in the Nicholsburg, right?
So what?
Well, so how do you call yourself? Or what? How
this is not like major league sports. You don't have to actually apply for a franchise. He obviously likes Schmelkum Nicholsburg, so he decided he's going to call himself a Nicholsburg.
It's so strange because
you know there's a Pittsburgh Rebbe, there's a Cleveland Rebbe, and of course there's the Boston Rebbe. I am the Bischofener Rebbe.
You're the what?
Bischofener Rebbe.
Bischofener. Where's Bischofener?
In Germany?
Germany. The Beck offers from the 1500s through 1933 lived an uninterrupted line in the town of Bischofen, which name Beck offer comes. And this franchise is mine. I am the Bischofener Rebbe. My brother, you're right. I'm hoarding this title for myself. You can have anybody from set up a Hasidus and take any name they want.
Well, I thought that was generally actually not done. That's why I heard through various and confirmed sources that this particular rabbi went through a lot of service to get to the status.
Yeah, because Satmar is a tough guy.
Well,
just because it's not really something.
Oh yeah.
Not because it's completely out of convention for a person to come.
No, no, because he broke up from Satmar and took people with him.
So that's generally almost never done.
In Satmar, it's never done.
But he did. They have a mosque. Yeah. Now, why do you say it's never done? What, besides getting, you know, a shrine thrown at your face or whatever, what's, I mean, well, what's the worst that they would do besides? I mean, maybe beat you up, but. You know,
Satmar. How much? Well, how much worth you wanted to get?
We shouldn't talk about that anyway. But anyway, but yeah, I was trying to clarify what the nature of the dynamic of starting a Hasidic dynasty is, and how do you get Chaisos to run the city for a name or a place? Well, or
they say Kalbach had a dynasty. They called them Kalbach. They called the Kalbach Hasidim.
Yeah. you get yourself a shtibel. You used to put on white socks on Shabbos. And a shrimal and a nice bakasha, a rebbish looking one, and you start giving tish, and eventually you become bigger and bigger and bigger, and maybe you'll get real chassidim.
How do you get the bakasha though? You said, how do you get the bakasha?
G&G.
Okay. That's like a bakasha shop in the city or something?
No, here, in Murphy.
The Rebbe store, right? Mm.
So I get my tish bakasha.
Nice. Yeah. Now, also, another rebbe recently said that. Getting into Hasidic or becoming Hasidic is not something generally done or not advisable by people who are not born frum, unless, like I think you said, they're very learned or they had at least 5 years of Orthodox life under their belt, so to speak. And otherwise, it ends with the long-term failure. What he exactly meant by failure or the criteria was, I'm not sure. But this really just made that kind of usual cautionary statement. Where was I going with that question? Let me ask another question. What's the most challenging aspect of this particular task of becoming Hasidic? I mean, what's usually the thing that undermines people? They find the most impossible.
You have to jettison your Western values at the door.
Oh shucks!
No, to an extreme. All goyim are bad. All tzionim are bad, right? It's a very. What?
Ever the rub, no? Your brother.
Why
not? Ever rub.
Arab, yeah, the
so
Arab, yeah, and you have to. You basically are, you know, it's not when a person comes to Baal Tshuva, usually they can keep most of their, you know, mores,
personality
from beforehand. It's just that now they're using it in a more constructive and certainly more observant manner. If you become Hasidish, you have to change your personality. Right?
Mm-hmm.
See, even in Litvisha circles, right? If you get an old Rosh Hashiva who's old enough, you can talk to him about the Flintstones. He'll know, he'll be in your same frame of reference because he watched the Flintstones when he was a kid.
What? But what if...
But you're not going to get that. Like,
that's the thing. What if a person doesn't want to talk about the Flintstones, doesn't want to talk about sports, doesn't necessarily want to talk about
No, but there's a lot of other things you can't talk about also. In other words,
such as any secular
thing having any value,
mm-hmm.
Right? English is a big problem, speaking in English. Certainly if you speak a good English, you're going to be suspect. And
a collaborator?
Sorry, a collaborator. Yeah. And generally speaking, you are put into a very, very different orbit than you were before. And if people are very aware of all this, and they are people who are on an even keel, then it can work. But if people are not aware of this, and or they're not on an even keel, so this is going to exacerbate their... eccentricities.
Psychologically.
I mean, like, emotionally well balanced.
Yeah.
If you're not emotionally well balanced, then you go to do a Hasidic thing, you just like,
I didn't remember the question, but he said that was the case. Roughly, you know, generally, this was the case. It was difficult, with two exceptions that he could think of, neither of which he could expound upon himself or put words in his mouth. I'll ask you. Said with the exception of Lubavitch and Boston Ephesus.
They're much more worldly. You don't have to sacrifice your, yourself at the door.
But would that then exclude groups that is what you described as the more on the far end of the world, most worldly end of the spectrum, Gehr, and in some cases Breslov, and
yeah, because Gehr also has you're going to enter a very highly regimented existence.
Mm-hmm.
Individuality is not, you know, a high priority. Whereas in the secular world, you know, in the world you come from, individuality is held in esteem.
Well, this applies to general system as well. People who, in other words, don't have a particular sect to which they belong, but they become specifically with
the right. Yes. But certainly in Gehr, when you bring up Gehr, there's certainly uniformity is the name of the game.
My friend who became from,
he said that the Litvishah world is also very difficult for someone.
The real Litvishah world, the Bnei Brak world. I have a great story I can tell you guys.
Why?
You want to hear a great story to finish with?
Why is that?
Okay, why can't I tell you a great story? Because it just happened.
No.
I'm going to explain. I'm going to answer your question with a story. Okay? But tomorrow night, we better on Navi. Okay, so the...
I apologize, you guys.
There's a popular sefer. Today in the Olam HaTorah called the Bilvavi Mishkan Evne. Who, anybody here ever used Bilvavi? Bilvavi Mishkan Evne. It's a book all about coming close to Hashem and thinking about Hashem. And it's very popular both in Hebrew and in English. And the author was making a tour of the United States last week before. So he came to our institution, our high school, and he spoke. And during lunch, he spoke to the Rabbein. And he said, I'm going to... The whole episode was 9 minutes long. But I'm going to make it even shorter, because it's late. But he said, I cannot speak about Avodas Hashem, which is the main thing, obviously, but which we would want to hear, unless people know Emes. Unless people are willing to recognize and acknowledge Emes. And you must know and acknowledge publicly that your institution is b'di'eved, sh'b'di'eved, sh'b'di'eved, sh'b'di'eved. Why? Why? It means that it is only exists as a accommodation of an accommodation of an accommodation of an accommodation. And that this is certainly not the way things are supposed to be. Now, he might have been talking about secular studies. He might have been talking about sports, which we have also. He might have been talking about the fact that we're in Chutz Laaretz. There are all things he could have talked about. But what he said was, any institution which teaches that it is legitimate l'chatchila for a person to go out and work, to have a career, is not true. It's promulgating a sheker. MS is that you can only a person who's weak or in financial ruin can go out to work. Other people must sit and learn day and night their entire lives. And if you're not moid on that MS, there's nothing to talk about. So actually nobody was moid on that MS, at least not explicitly. So he just said, okay, if I only came to say that, it was worth it, and he left.
Wow.
So that answers his question, although he left. So no question. That was that mentality, which is a pretty standard Bnei Brak. No,
Litvish.
Not Chassidish. No, Chassidish is not like that. Chassidim are much more willing to let you out to work. This mentality, which is very strict but standard Litvish mentality, is something which, you know, a person really, it's hard for lots of people to buy into. It's hard for me to buy into. So that's why people have difficulties with it.
See, obviously, he holds another
This has become standard doctrine. It's a Rishim Bar Yochai, based on Nefesh Chaim, understanding of Rishim Bar Yochai. And this is that you have to, Rav Shimon Yochai is really right, Rav Shmuel is really, and says you have to learn, and Rav Shmuel says you go out and make a job, that's really...
So how can they, in any honest way, expect any amount of services from people who did get secular... education,
that's a separate issue. In the meantime, at least they should, you want the short answer to that? The short answer is, well, at least they should have the schools of being Mishamish people who are in Torah.
Doesn't make sense, because if they didn't support people who were learning Torah, then these people, they wouldn't have any doctors or anything like that.
There'll be other doctors, the claim.
Is that
Arabs?
Thank you.
First of all, why don't you...